What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we'll be taking a look at the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, a historic treaty signing is on the cards after PNG's cabinet approved a security treaty with Australia. An oil spill from a World War II wreck in Micronesia is turning mangroves black. And as the NRL heads into grand final weekend, we take a look at the impact Pacific players are having on the sport. Pacific Review comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, Papua New Guinea and Australia are on track to signing a historic security treaty next week. It comes after PNG's cabinet approved the treaty text, paving the way for leaders of the two countries to sign off on the agreement. The Puk Puk Treaty is Australia's first new military alliance in more than 70 years and will see the two countries agree to defend each other in the event of a military attack. Dr. Bal Kama is an academic and a lawyer specializing in international relations and law in the Pacific.
It is a significant announcement. I think treaty is proposed. If it goes through, it'll be PNG's most significant bilateral relations commitment. It currently doesn't have a treaty with anyone, and the scope of the treaty in terms of security, again, added that extra importance. So it'll be a significant development for both. Now, it is not completely off the process yet. There's still a few steps to go, but it is definitely a significant announcement today.
What could prevent this treaty from getting over the line?
Well, the first step was for the two nations to decide on the terms of the treaty and the scope of it, and they have done that. The second step was to present that treaty to each of the cabinets. Canberra has done that, and PNG has now done it as a statement from the Prime Minister confirmed, and his cabinet has now approved it. And then the final step would be to present to the Parliament and to see if the parliamentarians or PNG Parliament would vote to accept it. And then the more binding aspect of it would be to ensure that that resolves in a domestic law. I think the third part or the third step here, presenting it to Parliament, is the more important one to see whether Parliament would approve.
In a statement, the Prime Minister clarified that the treaty will undergo the constitutional section 117 process with the ratification presented to the PNG Parliament. And then Australia is also going to undertake its own ratification through Parliament here in Canberra. We saw that there was a delay to the actual announcement and approval of the treaty. Could we expect a delay or issues with it going to Parliament?
When it was announced, Prime Minister Albanese was in Papua New Guinea 2 weeks ago for the announcement. There were already reactions from the PNG public, from Army General, from some politicians. So now with this cabinet approval, I think we will expect to see further reactions, and whichever way those reactions might lead, it's not really clear. But I think there will be public conversations around it, and then that could play into how the Parliament respond. But that said, Prime Minister Marape has the majority of the Parliament, more than the majority. I think that is something that could play into resulting in a favorable vote for his government.
What will China make of this announcement?
They have put up a statement 2 weeks ago on the back of Albanese's visit to Port Moresby, and the treaty discussions were happening. I think it'll be interesting to see whether China would have an interest now with this next phase of approval going through. But I think coming back to what the two leaders have tried to emphasize and what's coming through the statement from Marape now, from PNG side, it seems from Marape's position that it is not about geopolitics. It's about securing PNG's own domestic security needs.
Dr. Balkama, an academic and a lawyer specializing in international relations in the Pacific. While the treaty is expected to be signed off next week, not everyone is convinced it's in PNG's best interest. One critic is the opposition leader, Douglas Tomoriesa, who believes there are far greater priorities for his country.
Australia is serious about threats in the country? I don't think they are. They're more worried about us signing a treaty with them, a defense treaty, for their own good, for their own protection, and not for Papua New Guinea. So why can't we cancel this deal that will not benefit the nation, and let's come up with a proper package, a treaty to deal with local terrorism, to deal with the internal issues that we have in terms of law and order. You look at the drug cartels. They are using Papua New Guinea as a stopover.
And that's Douglas Tomoriesa, Papua New Guinea's opposition leader. You're listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company as we look through the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Leaders in the Federated States of Micronesia fear toxic oil leaking from a World War II shipwreck may just be the tip of the iceberg of what's to come over the coming years. A state of emergency has been declared after oil leaking from a Japanese shipwreck turned mangroves black and threatened marine life. Local government official Peter Aiton says the leaking Rio de Janeiro Maru is one of 64 shipwrecks in shallow waters off the coast of the Chuuk Lagoon.
Well, to put it in perspective, and thanks to your government of Australia, they help us do a study. They just finished up and they reported back, and the ambassador just submitted the report last April. And that report stated that within 5 to 10 years, there will be oil leakage. So that was last April. It's 5 months. I do not know if you call it escalated, but they did determine within 5 years. So.
Yeah, so yes. The timeline you were given was 5 years, but within 5 months, we have an oil spill from an old Japanese vessel, which your leader spoke about at the UN General Assembly.
Yes, Rio de Janeiro is the name of the ship. It's a Japanese auxiliary transport. It's east of one of our islands called Uman.
And how was the leak discovered? Was it discovered by like local fishermen, or was it local villagers who, you know, saw a discoloration in the water?
Both, because it's very close to the island, so the locals found oil seepage and also a dive ship that does operations over here. What they have informed us is that it looks like the pressure was just too much. Our dive experts over here are also thinking of other things that might have happened, like changing weather and all that. So they were not able to get in there because it's too risky. We don't want them to take a chance.
And this particular vessel, is it relatively shallow?
Yes, it's within 40 feet.
And what impact has this had on the local population? Like, has a food source been contaminated? Has it impacted local fishermen?
Currently, we are telling the locals to stay away from the water. The oil has reached inland, has affected the mangrove and like that. Of course, it's dark, it's black. At the beginning of the oil leakage, it was up to 4 inches. It affected the docks and everything on there, the sea life.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the four affected villages don't have deep well. They're using rainwater. So there is no contamination of their local water. But they have been reported cases of dizziness and all like that due to the fumes and the smell of the oil.
That's good news that there's no contamination to the local water sources, but that's not to say that there might not be down the track. So what can be done to fix the issue? I mean, you've obviously raised the matter at the UN General Assembly.
Well, we have sent and requested our partners from US, Japan, even Australia for assistance in whatever we can. We do have damping mats that suck up the oil whenever we put the mats down and like that. And that's what we're currently using to clean up. We're also using detergents, soap and all like that to also help clean up.
Yeah, but I guess that's probably only a temporary solution at the moment, isn't it? Because there would be so much oil, I imagine, in that ship.
Well, I'll give you a perspective of how much oil. The Australian study showed that it's between 600 to 1,500 tons of oil left.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Looking beyond that, you know, this is just one ship. I mean, there's a number of ships that currently lie on the bottom of the seafloor in those shallow waters around Chook Lagoon. Looking ahead, do you hold fears that these other ships might also start to deteriorate at a rapid rate?
That is very obvious. This is just the beginning. We have officially 63 shipwrecks in the lagoon. So this will be the first one that is leaking out. And if this Australian study showed, they did a study on 20 of the shipwrecks. And their estimate is from 3.5 to 6 million gallons of oil still in our waters. So that would be a very big devastation if one or two or all of them.
And that was Peter Aiton. He's the Division Chief of Commerce and Industry in the state of Chuuk, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Kyle Evans. The Pacific Island nations are on the front line of climate change, but the UN talks designed to help often happen on the other side of the world. That could be about to change, with Australia vying to host next year's UN climate talks, promising to do it alongside the Pacific. So what could it mean for Pacific people to have the conference in their own backyard? Well, the ABC's reporter, Jordan Fennell, took a look into this story.
Year after year, the United Nations COP climate conferences roll on, but they almost always take place far from the Pacific, where communities are experiencing some of the worst effects of climate change. Joseph Sikulu is a longtime Tongan Australian climate activist, and he says COPs can be a disappointing experience.
The hardest thing about the COP process is having to celebrate incrementalism when we know that we are fast running out of time, and it's disheartening and it's heartbreaking.
But he believes that Pacific people deserve a platform.
If you look at the COP process and the history of this and who has been driving the ambition within those negotiations, you will see that it's the Pacific. If anybody is owed a COP in this world, it's the Pacific.
He says this is especially true given how hard it is for Pacific Islanders to even get to these high-level talks.
We're talking about people having to travel over 24 hours to take part in the negotiations and what that costs. And the thing is, if we're not part of this, we're invisible.
Coral Pacisi is the Climate Change Director at Pacific International Development Organization, SPC. She says after a long journey, there's then the challenge of implementing policies. But new initiatives to increase access to finance for climate mitigation and adaptation are part of the solution.
The finance really underpins everything for us. The types of resource commitments that have been made, I think those ingredients bring us closer to finding some resolution.
For Ms. Pacisi, engaging young Pacific people in this complex process is key. It's also something Pacific Youth Council Chair Mahoney Mori is keenly aware of.
We need to localize it, localize the COP concept. Having pre and post COP conferences would really help, given the expensive, how expensive, and I mean, there's so many travel barriers when it comes to participating in COP.
As Pacific youth like Mahoney rally to energise the COP process, they're continuing the fight championed by leaders like former Kiribati President Anote Tong.
And I think we really have to scrutinise what it is that we're doing. Why are we hosting the COP? Is it for symbolism or is it to solve and address the problem?
Mr. Tong says he's seen the power in showing decision makers climate impacts firsthand, including former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon during a visit to Kiribati.
His very words worth this. I've listened to you speak year after year at the General Assembly, but I must admit I never, ever truly understood until now.
But Mr. Tong warns convincing nations, especially large fossil fuel emitters, to act is never easy.
And so they come to these discussions from an economic perspective, whereas we come to these discussions from an issue of survival.
Last year, the chief executive of Azerbaijan's COP29 team was secretly recorded planning to broker new oil and gas deals while at the event.
Greenwashing is possibly too nice a word for that. What basically it is just making false promises.
With Australia now bidding to host COP31, Anote Tong is challenging the government to act. The
question is, will Australia come in with and for the Pacific, or will it come in with its own political agenda?
And that was former Kiribati President Anote Tong speaking there. It's said that the Pacific is made up of 2% land and 98% ocean. It's a vast expanse that Pacific nations are responsible for managing and protecting. As the ABC's Chris Enrita Amanu Leong reports, it's a challenging task, but one that many nations are working together to overcome.
In this little village along Timor-Leste's northern coast, Anibal's family has fished for generations.
I became a fisherman when I was young. Being a fisherman used to be an easy job to earn a good income.
But these days, it's harder to make a living. Climate change has taken a toll, and so too illegal fishing. Less than 20 kilometres away is the Indonesian border, and there's no formal maritime boundary between the two countries.
The reefs have been damaged and there's illegal fishing from people who come in fish in Biaku without permission from the government.
The Pacific is often thought of as small islands, but really they are vast ocean states responsible for governing some of the world's most abundant marine territories. While the ocean is a vital livelihood for the Pacific, protecting it from illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, or more simply, IUU fishing, is a big task.
My name is Sahril. I've been in Bomana prison for 9 months.
My name is Arif Yuga Arianto. I was arrested on 22nd October 2024 in Papuan waters.
In the past year, 38 Indonesian fishermen have been locked up in Bomana prison, their vessels confiscated and destroyed. They were all arrested in an area called the Dogleg. It's PNG's exclusive economic zone, but there is no formally agreed maritime border with Indonesia in this area. Paul Barker from the Institute of National Affairs says the Dogleg is prone to illegal fishing along the coastline and further offshore.
It's a difficult area to clearly designate and identify. They sometimes have connections with villages in coastal or island areas of PNG, but they're very hard to monitor, especially when the villages themselves are not really reporting them. Sometimes because they're trading with them, getting goods and other services from them.
In Solomon Islands, the Pacific Islands Foreign Fisheries Agency supports 17 member countries who make up 30% of the global tuna catch. Its Director General, Noan Pakop, says unreported fishing make up 5% of all illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing.
It used to be a bigger problem in the past. Now with the emerging technology that has helped us be able to keep tab on the activities out at sea.
At their headquarters in Honiara, Commander Simon Gregg oversees a sophisticated surveillance centre.
One of the challenges is just the enormity of the Pacific and our area of operation, what we're trying to surveil and
and you know, conduct counter IU operations is 30 million square kilometres.
Pacific nations have long struggled to get the most out of their tuna money. Fish caught in the Pacific is often processed elsewhere, only to be re-imported back into the region in cans. FFA Director General PACOP says its members are trying a different approach with Papua New Guinea's East New Britain initiative, which could prove lucrative.
Just imagine those catch are processed within and exported out of the country. The returns coming from that will double, will triple in many different forms.
That was Noan Pakop, the FFA Director General, ending that story by the ABC's reporter in Solomon Islands, Chris and Rita Amanu Leong. This weekend, the Brisbane Broncos take on Melbourne Storm in the NRL Grand Final. More than half of the players on the field will be of Pacific Islander and Maori heritage. Not only does this highlight the Pacific presence in the sport of rugby league, it shows the evolution of the sport. The ABC's Finau Fonua spoke with rugby league commentator David Middleton about the impact of Pacific Islands people and culture in the sport.
We knew nothing about our cousins, regional cousins in the Pacific before rugby league. So it's been very interesting that this game has taken these tiny islands. There's only 200,000 people in Samoa and about the same number in, around the same number in Tonga. And has we've been able to understand their lifestyles, and they've culturally upended the game. So it's a lot more hip hop than rock music. It was rugby league was originally a Christian sport, and it's returning to being a Christian sport. You're seeing on field prayer circles, and it's also interesting to see the adaptation. Commentators having to learn Pacific names and different personality types. There's when you're dealing with Pacific players, you need to sometimes engage with the pastor of the church. Religion is very central, and often decisions are made on a collective basis as befits a collective society. So the parents have an enormous say in what the kid does, where the player plays. And we're talking 51% Pacifica Māori this year in the NRL. And I've done some figures, and it's 55% of both teams, both 34 players on the field for the NRL Grand Final are either of Pacific or Māori background. So about the same percentage you're seeing across the league, you'll see representation in the Grand Final on Sunday.
And while they're all eligible for international representation, I mean, not just for Australia and New Zealand, but for their Pacific Island countries, what's your opinion on this at the NRL final?
The most important thing and most positive thing to come out of this is the rebirth of international rugby league. International rugby league was dead. Australian fans were not going out to watch the Kangaroos. England and occasionally New Zealand would put up some resistance, but Australia won World Cup after World Cup. The international game was threatened as a spectacle. Now that we have this Pacific representation in rugby league, we have NRL class players going back now and making their grandparents thrilled and their parents thrilled by representing their ancestral countries, to the point where we have six teams, five and potentially PNG, that could make the semifinals and potentially win the World Cup now if everything goes their way. So a weakening of Australia and an increasing of the strength of the other countries has really given rugby league an international flavour that it didn't have for a long, long time since France stopped being competitive in the 1980s. It's been only three countries that could challenge, and it's no good. So I think this has been the best thing, is this rise of Pacific teams filled with NRL players has meant that World Cups and Pacific Championships, and we have the Pacific Championships coming up between Tonga and Samoa, and I think there is anticipation levels in some parts of the communities at the level of State of Origin fever about that game, and that will definitely sell out at Suncorp Stadium, and this wasn't happening 20 years ago. So this is huge for rugby league and huge for our engagement with our Pacific neighbours.
That championship game between Tonga and Samoa, the level of excitement being at State of Origin level, could you expand on that?
Well, I think formally putting it together into an annual Pacific Championships has been the very important first step. So Tonga and Samoa, effectively a 1,000-year-old ancient rivalry, which is now reconstituting through rugby league. And it's actually bringing those two communities together in a way. They're sitting side by side. They're getting resources now. They're getting attention together. And that's a great Polynesian rivalry that will one day generate similar excitement to some of the other big games in rugby league. And I think it's already there.
And that was David Middleton, rugby league commentator, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Finau Funua. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again next week for more news and views from across the Pacific region.